first of all, about the whole question around authentic voice and the necessity to support Native authentic voice. I know that there has been a controversy, especially in Canada and North America, in relation to that subject, and that may be something that's unique to Canada. I'm not sure about that. But in brief, part of the controversy around it is the question of literary rights and censorship, and the ability to create fiction without any kind of censoring from any cultural groups. On the one hand, that is the controversial points relating to non-Native authors who have relied on Native stories and legends, myths, and contemporary stories as well to create the fiction from. The other side of the controversy is from Natives and minorities, Black minorities and Asian minorities, who have been speaking out quite loudly in the last few years, trying to bring their view across in regards to this, the whole question of what authentic voice is in terms of the Native people, Black people, and so on. Just to make it clear in terms of my understanding, as I do not wish to become embroiled in that polarization of concepts, because it doesn't allow us the opportunity to dialogue about a really critical question, which is a question of cultures coming into contact with one another, and which must somehow be sorted out and understood by both sides of the culture by whatever mechanisms they might have available. And the voice speaking to one another, dialogue, reading one another, is an important mechanism for that. What I would like to do, rather than take sides or take positions, is to try to give you some background on Native voice and authenticity in Native voice, and some of the reasons why it is important at this time to support and promote Native literary voice internationally and nationally. So that's where the focus of my talk is at this point in time, rather than to bash anyone or rather than to take sides. I guess one of the questions that comes up when we are speaking about authentic voice in the Native tradition is to ask, what are you speaking about? What are the important parts of, from my own perspective, what are the important parts of Native voice that you count as authentic? What is it to you? And principally because I'm involved in developing a nurturing ground for Native literary voice, it's important for me to ask myself that question. It's important for me to find some answers to that question from my own community. In relation to the Okanagan, where I come from, I have a good knowledge and a good background in traditional voice. And my understanding of my culture, I think I have received a good education from my teachers and from my elders, and I'm very fortunate because of that. I'm a fluent speaker of Okanagan, and I've been taught the Hai language, which is the language of the political leaders and the language of the medicine people, the keepers of certain kinds of traditions. And there are very few people my age that speak that level of Okanagan. The pedestrian level of Okanagan, which is like your street English, is spoken by more people. And then there's the formative Okanagan, which is a language that's used by children, basically. And sort of like, kitty talk. So there's a lot more people using that form of Okanagan. In terms of the High Okanagan, and I'm told that this is true of most languages. It's true of English, probably true of Germany, that there's a more complex, abstract form of language that you would call academic English rather than standard English, and maybe so in German. So some of the abstract concepts are formed by the intellectuals, the thinkers and the philosophers, and the carriers, the historians, the carriers of our knowledge and information in that form of our language, and is not completely available at the pedestrian level, although that is used as a form of communication as well and can capture with a lot more words and images and performance as well. In terms of the question of voice, I must say that originally, as I understand it, our stories were all oral in presentation, were all constructed to be oral in presentation. So part of the past 100 years or more in Canada has been not only shifting to speaking English and using English in terms of fluency, but also in shifting from the oral communication form and orality to a written communication form, which is in our language passive and not active. We've got an active form of communications. So that's a whole another aspect that I don't want to speak about in terms of the difference between written and orality. The whole question around our traditional stories, and I can only speak from the Okanagan point of view now, because I am not knowledgeable about all the other cultures, and certainly you must be aware that we don't have a monolithic Indian culture in North America, that it's made up of many cultures in the same way that Europe is made up of many cultures and many languages and many regions, all which are formed by various experiences, both historical and geographical, and it's very much the same in the United States and Canada. The environment there has had, the geography, I should say, there has had a great deal of influence like anywhere else, where cultures are land-based and depend on the land for survival. The kinds of languages that grow out of that, of social customs, the kinds of philosophical worldview that grows out of that has its roots in the geography and the experience upon that land. And we know this from our own culture, that our language is a result of our geography. Our language is a result of our experience on our land and our environment. And our experience with one another, our interaction with one another, is also dependent upon our relationship to that environment, and that the way that we constructed our societies and the way that we developed our philosophical ideals around how those customs fit into our everyday practice in terms of practical functioning, everyday lifestyle, how we use the resources on our land is a very important part of our language, and a very important part of the teaching that must be in some way a priority in order to ensure the same kind of healthy lifestyle for the next generation. So we come back to stories. My understanding of that is that implicit in the stories of our people, implicit in the structure of the stories, the development of the stories, the development of the drama, the voice, and the very specific kinds of word uses are societal structures, customs, philosophical ideals, and values that speak and embed the principles that are important for that community to survive in a specific way on that environment, very specifically. So we didn't have schools. We didn't need schools. Our institution for education were our parents and our storytellers and the people in the extended family. They had to be able to transfer very, very specific knowledge about the environment. in, and not only for this generation, but many generations, upon how you used your resources on that particular piece of land. And the stories contain very clear information in relation to that, very specific and practical information about that. But beyond that, the stories contain very clear societal rules in terms of philosophical principles and values, not only in terms of how we relate to one another to ensure healthy survival and continuance, but how we relate to each other in relation to the rest of the environment. That's a very important part in terms of looking at traditional stories. That's a very important understanding that I need to share with you in relation to the language and the stories and the consequent subsequent literature that arises out of authentic Native voice. That brings you to the whole question of the present in terms of colonization and the years after contact. In relation to the past, our cultures in the Okanagan and elsewhere in North America were thriving cultures, and I understand that some of the comparisons may be comparisons around use of technology or misuse of technology, as I like to put it, in terms of how civilized you were. I think it takes a great deal of civilization and understanding and knowledge not to misuse technology in an unhealthy way. And it takes a great deal of sensitivity to the interconnectedness of all things, all life forms on this earth, in order to be able to live for thousands of generations on the same piece of land without destroying or without altering that land in any way that was visible. Our people achieved that. Our peoples all over North America achieved that. And this I'm very proud of, because I know that the country's peoples who maintain that they are superior in civilization have not achieved that, did achieve it at one point, and disintegrated into chaos and anarchy and war and violence of all kinds. And I'm not here to speak about that, but that's my point of view, and so you know where I'm coming from. In relation to the impact of colonization, the impact of violence to the land, the impact of disrespect to people coming together and learning from one another and sharing together, is very much the history of the past 500 years that affirms itself in terms of the statistics about my people. Anywhere in the Americas or anywhere in any of the colonized countries, you don't need to look at the stories. All you need to do is read the statistics to understand what the story is, to understand what happened, to know the reality. And I don't have to recount any of that to you. You all know that in the Americas, in the space of 20 years after the first contact, more people died there than any of the world wars. More annihilation. 20 million people in Cortez's time in the space of 20 years. That kind of slaughter is a story that needs to be relooked at, that needs to be understood, and the continuous and continuation of that over the next subsequent 500 years is a reality that we're speaking out of, is a reality in terms of our struggle, and is a reality in terms of our seeking to maintain our own peaceful integrity and to be exemplars of that without falling into the same pit ourselves. And this is what I speak for. This is where I come from. And this is what I hope that my writing will assist in and my words will assist in. When I was speaking about the stories themselves, imparting that information, imparting that knowledge, the implicit part of it, then it comes to the question of reinterpretation, cultural reinterpretation. colonization and imperialism. This is where I find a difficulty with. I find a very, very strong and harsh reality in place which tells me you cannot reinterpret. You cannot recreate what was not there until you listen, until you hear the stories, until you have learned, until you have gone to school, until you have gained an education. And it is time in this world, it is time at this point for humanity to become educated, to educate themselves, to be willing to listen. And I'm not saying that Native peoples have the complete answer. Certainly we are in a condition now in this world where no one has the answers, and we are all seeking answers in terms of coming together and interacting with one another and forming new ways of finding better cultural ways to interact. And so literature becomes a very important part of that. The voicing of the anger, the pain of the past, but also the voicing of the affirmation of cultural knowledge, which may be beneficial and positive, are both necessary and important in terms of creating conditions for dialogue, meaningful dialogue with thinking people, meaningful dialogue with people who are interested in change, as well as interested in supporting the kind of work that needs to be done that says we will no longer accept what is intolerable in this world. I wanted to speak a little more specifically about the whole question of philosophical values and our struggle at this point in time as writers, Native writers. And I cannot claim that all Native writers are saying the same thing, are coming from the same point of view, or have the same purpose in writing. But I do know this. I do know that we all have experienced the same history, our mother's history, our father's history, our grandmother's and grandfather's history, as well as the time when our original cultures were in place, as well as the time when we know that our people were not barbarians and savages and ignorant and without any knowledge. And that, I think, is common to Native writers, whether they're from the urban experience or whether they're from the rural reservation experience. Somewhere in the background are the origin stories, the original philosophical values and the principles which make our communities different from other communities. And also the understanding that we have is that we have not relinquished our relationships and interrelationships to our environment. We have not been removed to a point in which those relationships don't matter anymore. And I may be wrong in saying this, but in my reading, as someone, Marcos, mentioned, that is clear to me that those relationships are there, whether they're practiced. And the practical functioning of everyday life is a question, but those philosophical ideals are undercurrents of voice, and they are available. And my concern is not so much in relearning a cultural past and a cultural history that can never be relived and reshaped in exactly the same way, because cultures evolve and change continuously, coming into contact with peoples, forever shapes and changes that culture in terms of thinking and new ideas and new knowledge, and that's not necessarily an unhealthy thing. That can be a healthy change for both sides. But in terms of Native cultures and Native peoples, I do know that throughout the struggle, there have been Native peoples, philosophers, thinkers, medicine people, carriers of history, who have maintained principles that are important, values that are important, and structures, and most important of all, process. This I see to be the most integral and important aspect of the linkages and interconnections between one another in terms of a learning process. And this, I see, is what is central and important to being supportive of authentic voice and original voice in terms of not only reading the material, but actively understanding and promoting it and finding out where it can be read and where it can assist in change. It has been explained to me by my elders very clearly, and I have tried to be a student in terms of learning and transforming that learning in the process into function. In other words, doing, not just being a receptacle for information, but having that information find a place in terms of the world around me, in terms of how I function, what I do, and what I stand for and what I change out there. And for me, that's the important part, the transformation. Someone was talking about Trickster here. My clear vision of Trickster is the transformer, not the products on either end, where he started from or where it ends, not the product in terms of books and in terms of poetry or in terms of music, arts, whatever it might be, to hang on the wall. But the use of that in our functioning, living reality, the transforming of our reality, the changing of our reality. Because that changing comes from our perception. We create this world. We as human beings have created this reality here. Every one of us has contributed to that. Every one of us is responsible to that. Every one of us is a part of that. And we're very powerful, very, very, very powerful in how many people in our lifetimes that we impact simply by action or non-action, doing or not doing. And for myself, that's the important part of hearing and learning new thinking, because as I understand it, Western thought is product-oriented. And technology, the runaway technology, has become a measure of the philosophical functioning. If we look around us, the functioning world around us is very much an expression of that, very much an expression of philosophical values and ideals, which become action, which become what is happening around us. That cannot change without the individual changing. That cannot change without the desire for a better relationship, for a different relationship. That cannot change without our compliance with it. That is the essence, as we understand it, of democracy. That is the essence of consensus making as we understand it. Not numbers and a majority being told you, because there's more of you, you have more of a right to coerce this other small group into doing what you want them to do. That's about numbers. That's about power. So in terms of literature, in terms of Native literature, it's not the numbers. It's the voice out there. The possibility of one voice coming across. One voice making that change, that transformation, creating that possibility in another person. And I see that happening. That's magic. I understand that's magic. That's Trickster's magic. It is. It's happening now. We can see outside of the chaos that has been brought into this world, that there is a mind change, that there is going to be changes brought about because Native American thinking and other indigenous peoples and other peoples who are tired of the deconstructive philosophical values. Deconstructivism has been there as a bastion of philosophical study for how many years now? We need a new paradigm. We need to change that. And I think the literatures of Native people are paramount in their simplicity, in terms of being able to provide concentration on product. I hope it's not a concentration on seeking out those few people who sound the most like European literary writers and, you know, putting those voices up there and continuously speaking about those voices, how well they've been able to assimilate into European philosophical thought and structures of thinking in terms of literature. We have a word which was given to us as a gift. The word is Inaukan. The word Inaukan comes from our high language, and it's a word that I like to share with everyone and encourage everyone to think about in terms of their process, in terms of how they approach others and the world around them. The word Inaukan, in our language is constructed of syllables, which are the basis of meaning rather than words. So you can take a whole lot of syllables and move them around and get different meanings out of them. This particular word is a word which, if you were to give it a literary translation, it would mean something close to dropping water or something liquid through the top of the head, and that it would permeate the body in sort of an osmosis process without any struggle. But in terms of protocol, our leaders use it. When a question comes before them that everyone is concerned about, that people don't have answers or solutions for, the word Inaukan is then used by usually the facilitator, who might be the chief or the spokesperson or whatever, and asks very deliberately for each person to give the most opposite point of view to the normal, standard, prevailing one. And you're asked and you're challenged to give the most opposite argument to any person who raises a point of view. And by doing that, the receivers of the information are obligated not to debate and argue for their point of view. They're obligated to try as clearly as possible to integrate the most opposite point of view with their own. And so the consensus making in our community is based on Inaukan, and is based on bringing the most different and opposite point of view into integration with the thinking of the others without conflict or confrontation or argument or the polarizing that happens when I'm right and you're wrong and you have to stay on that side and I have to stay on this side. It brings together a healthy growth of learning, a healthy integration of all different points of view. I like to make that example because I think that an Inaukan center is very central to that idea, very central to the idea of challenging and bringing about the kind of dialogue that we must be courageous about at this time in our existence, that we must be forthright in terms of challenging and bringing forward the most opposite point of thinking without conflict, without defensiveness, and trying to integrate the thinking together, not into one point of view, but into a process in which all points of view are clearly understood in terms of whether it's destructive or whether it's healthy to this group or that group. And so that's why I say democracy is not about numbers. Democracy is about an integration of thinking that takes the most smallest minority into account and makes clear that that minority has a right and a very clear place in terms of the integration of thought. And I think if those of you that study Six Nations political history in the back, that's the basis for a really unique kind of structure that they proposed as the Tree of Peace. I believe in the Tree of Peace. Our peoples have formed an alliance. The Okanagan have formed an alliance with the Haudenosaunee people. And in the meeting with them, they accepted our principles and our ideals as being the same as theirs. And so we're principally now at this point in time in alliance with that philosophy. I wanted to further on to an Elkin Center and its role in terms of authentic voice. We have been seeking a way in which to move the voice of people from the silencing that has occurred in the past years of colonization because of language and because of politics and because of religion and because of race. All of those questions have been a form or a tool of silencing for our peoples. We have had to fight on all of those fronts. We have had to resist on all of those fronts. We have had to, at some points, take a position which is very clearly confrontationist in some of those areas where survival of our relatives on the land is imminent. We count in the Okanagan every living thing as part of our existence, as part of our body. We know very clearly from our stories that everything we eat becomes our flesh. Everything around us becomes part of us in terms of what we breathe and what becomes ultimately us in the physical form. And we know that when pieces of that are destroyed, that it's painful. It's physically painful to us because of the process that we are aware of and the way that we perceive it, our perception of it. And we know that confrontation may not be the best means to stop what is happening, but sometimes the anger results, the rage results, and then that results in dialogue, that results in somebody's ear opening up. Maybe not in the best way, but ultimately we find that there's two roles to look at in terms of the voice of colonized indigenous peoples in North America. One is the voice of pain, which is speaking out of a reality that very difficult to understand without looking at the whole context of how the imperialism took place and colonization took place in terms of the mind, the spirit, the body, the land, and all of the things that everyone holds dear as part of their existence. On the other hand, there's the affirmation, the voice of affirmation, which speaks about those very things that affirm beauty and health and affirm strength and affirm the processes which we know to be superior in terms of health on this planet. So in terms of the Anaukin Center, we will not be part of the silencing. We will not actively participate in negating a singular voice from speaking out and from having the validity of being heard and having the right to be heard. And sometimes, because of the academic structures in place, I don't know how else to put it, the silencing takes place as a result of literary criticism, as a result of certain kinds of ideals that are pursued in terms of literature and stories and how they should be shaped. And in particular in Canada, where the buying and selling of books is not based on quality but based on numbers. Again, you know, if the book is going to sell 5,000 copies, then regardless of what the quality is, you're going to get it published. But if it's perceived by the publisher as not being of pedestrian quality that is acceptable by the dominant society, then you're likely not going to get published. It's about money and numbers rather than about what needs to be said, what needs to be heard, what should be said and what should be heard, or what should be there as quality, or what could be there as quality, potentially. So that becomes a problem in terms of trying to find mechanisms to address that. Realistic, functional, everyday reality kinds of things. And that's where the danger zones are in terms of Native writers in a contemporary sense. How much do you posture in order to get published, in order to get read? How much do you sell yourself to meet that criteria out there in order to be published, in order to be read. What are the criteria? How do we ourselves try to find our way around those criteria that may be abhorrent to us in terms of what needs to be written, how it needs to be written, how it is accepted or acceptable out there? Those are questions that we, and ultimately only we as Native writers, can answer for ourselves in terms of our cultural integrity and our individual integrities in terms of what our purpose, as we see it, is. Part of an Anoukan's school is to find mechanisms to do that. Part of it, and the major part of it, is to support the individual, to affirm the individual in terms of their own integrity, their own voice. They, by virtue of being born human, was given a memory, was given a voice. They have the right to speak, and they have the right to be heard. This is what our understanding of democracy is. And we have tried in various ways to make that more possible by supporting the individual in terms of where they come in at, in relation to their own integrity, their cultural integrity, their tribal, their community, their national identity, without trying to interfere, but trying to assist them. And that's part of the work that we do at Anoukan. And of course, ultimately out of that is to provide more literature, more voices, more writing out there. And ultimately out of that, for the important change mechanisms to surface, and the contribution to the rest of the thinking world, where that silencing might hinder the progress that we all need at this time in our future, and our children's future, and the future of our planet. I would like to make one comment about misinterpretation in terms of focus and context. One of the concerns that I have, which I really ask rather than suggest, is a question that always comes up when we're speaking about the question of authentic voice versus appropriation and censorship. I ask myself, and I ask others, the question related to the whole idea of what literature voice might be. And I ask myself in terms of interpretation of that voice, especially from the Native perspective, what is the motivating force? What is central to a person at some point in their time deciding that they have interpreted correctly without seeking some affirmation of that nature? And I guess I ask myself that question, and I ask others that same question, in terms of how the receivers of that information, how the people who receive that information allow themselves to receive that information without questioning it. That's where I think the question lies, rather than in the writing of it. It's in the receiving of that information. In other words, the readers, the audience, and the people who willingly participate in the ongoing misrepresentation, misinterpretation. And I'm not saying that there's some good thinking that culminates as a result of that, in terms of sharing cultural thought and dialogue. That's the question that I think we can ask ourselves. Each one of us, we can ask ourselves that question, and we can answer it with as much integrity as possible in terms of supporting and promoting authentic voice, and allowing ourselves to be a part of that process in which we're not afraid, and we're courageous, and we're fearless in terms of allowing things that may not be comfortable for us to hear, to be brought forward, to be discussed, give us enlightenment in what we shouldn't do or should do, as Trickster may point out to us. you teach both by knowing what not to do and by knowing what to do, and we must strike a balance between. And our, one of our favorite words in our, each of our languages is to be able to walk that balance, and to be able to understand that balance, and to be able to achieve that balance in our everyday and personal lives and project that outward. I was really nervous about bringing this topic and talking about it, principally because I don't have any answers. All I can do is give you my thinking on it and give you my best thinking on it, more in the line of questions, I guess, than in the line of telling you what the answers might be or what to think about. But in terms of my people, I know what it has cost for us not to be heard and for us to continue to be silenced. And I will not be silenced. And if I can help it, many of my people will no longer be silent. And I think that I will leave it at that point. I wanted to read to you a poem which talks about this particular point of view that I was bringing to you, because I didn't have any real way of saying some of the things that I want to say, because I can't speak to you in my language. I can't tell you exactly what I want to tell you. So poetry comes closer for me to saying the exact things I've been trying to say in this past, I don't know how long, too long? So I wanted to read you one poem, and then I'd like to say I'm grateful for your listening and for your inviting me here, and for the treatment that we have had throughout Germany. People have been wonderful to us and have treated us with real dignity and integrity, and I really appreciate that. It's been very good. I've been a very good visit here, and I do hope to come back here at some point. Called Threads of Old Memory. Speaking to newcomers in their language is dangerous, for when I speak, history is a dreamer, empowering thought from which I awaken the imaginings of the past, bringing the sweep and surge of meaning, coming from a place rooted in memory, the memory of loss experienced in ceremonies wrenched from the minds of a people whose language spoke harmony through a language meant to overpower, to overtake, in skillfully crafted words moving towards surrender, surrender, leaving in its swirling wake only those songs hidden, cherished, protected, the secret singing of which I glimpsed through bewildered eyes an old, lost world of astounding beauty. When I speak, I attempt to bring together with my hands gossamer-thin threads of old memory, thoughts from the underpinnings of our understanding, words steeped in age, slim, barely visible strands of harmony, stretching across the chaos brought into this world through words, words shaped as sounds in air, meanings made physical, changers of the world, words, carriers into this place of things from a place of magic, the underside of knowing, the origination place, a pure place, silent and wordless. From where thoughts I choose silently transform, I speak and powerfully becomes action, becomes memory, someone. I become different memories to different people, different stories in the retelling of my place. I am the dreamer, the choice maker, the word speaker. I speak in a language of words, form of actions of the past, words that become the sharing, the collective knowing, the links that become a people, the dreaming that becomes a history, the calling forth of voices, and the sending forward of memory. I am the weaver of memory threads, twining the past to the future. I am the artist, the storyteller, the singer. From the known and familiar, I push out into darkness, dreaming splinters together in a coming to knowing. When I speak, I sing a song called up through ages of carefully crafted rhythm of a purpose close to the wordless, in a coming to this world, from the cold and hungry spaces in the heart, through the desolate and lost places of the mind, to this stark and wind-swept mountaintop, I search for the sacred words. Sacred words spoken serenely in the gaps between memory, the lost places of history, pieces mislaid, forgotten, or stolen, muffled by violence, splintered by evil. When languages collide in mid-air, when past and present explode in chaos, and the imaginings of the past rip into the dreams of the future. And when I speak, I choose the words gently, asking why. Dangerous words.